All right. I entitled this breakout session as Kodeshim, because when you get into the Messianic movement and or Hebraic roots and you start studying Torah, you bump into, of course, you're wrestling with these issues of the law and Torah. Am I under the law, and what does that mean? And 613 commandments. Well, you know, what do I do? What do I don't do? And how do I do it? And so everybody's kind of all over the place. And as they grow and they go through the Torah cycle, certain things will jump out to people. And then they talk to other believers at Sukkot and other feasts and festivals. And during that time, you know, you'll meet people that will wear their zitzits on their belt loops, and some will wear it on their tallit, and you know, and some will grow out their beards, and some wear kippahs, and some wear hats, and everything in between. And early on in our walk, when we first came into this, we did likewise. You know, we were learning and figuring it all out, and just trying to figure out what to apply to our lives. And I remember early on in the home fellowship group that we started out with, many discussions, and not at a low volume level, about certain things in Torah. There'd be darn right some arguments. And we were at actually our first Sukkot, and two families that we were in fellowship with got... The gentleman in this family and the wife in this family got into an argument over the observance of the festival and what was allowed and what wasn't allowed on the high Sabbath during the Feast of Sukkot. And from that small little disagreement, it escalated into, you need to control your wife, and then they get all into this discussion. And by the time we got home, we had two congregations in this small town in Kansas instead of one, because they had splintered and broke off, and everybody was mad. And you know, half the group went one direction, the other half went one direction. I went home. I was kind of disgusted with the whole process, and I had both of them calling me, going, oh, which way are you going to decide? And I'm like, I just think you guys are being stupid. You know? And so eventually we made one decision, and then I tried to get everybody unified back in. The interesting thing is, as everybody's growing and learning, they learn at different levels and different paces and all this stuff. And a good friend of ours years ago made a very simple comment, and she wasn't always a very deep person, but this one time she made this comment, and it always stuck with me, and it was that some people, when they go after God, some people crawl, some people walk, and some people run. And so your period of time within the Hebraic Roots movement or studying Torah is not necessarily equal to your knowledge, observance, and maturity in the Torah. And just because your observance in some areas doesn't always equal your spiritual maturity in others. So here we are, we got 613 commandments in the Torah. And I used to have a friend that would say, anytime somebody goes, 613, you mean you got to do all that law? And he said, well, if you want to get technical, there's a list of the commandments in the New Testament, and there's 1,089. And they say you have to do that one. And so he's right from that standpoint. But I've always kind of liked to come back to Scripture, because we can argue Rashi and we can argue Maimonides and all these great rabbis and what they feel is important. And we can argue Shammai and Hillel and all this. But when it comes down to it, God's really the major authority on commandments and how we walk these out in our lives, right? And really, the way you walk out the commandments of the Lord in your life is how God places it upon your heart. And if you tend to be in disobedience and want to do something, you know, that's contrary to that, well, I guess that's your issue, and you know, God will hold you accountable for it to a point. I mean, there's blatant disobedience, and then there is just things we do out of simple ignorance of not knowing. And there's nothing wrong with ignorance. I mean, we're all ignorant at some level. I mean, and none of us have it all figured out. You know, there isn't a single person in this room that probably couldn't be shown up pretty good by a 12-year-old yeshiva student in Jerusalem in regard to just about anything Torah related, because they've been immersed in it from the time, you know, they were born. So from that standpoint, and speaking, I believe that God gives us a pattern about the 613 commandments and these things in Scripture of the weightier things of the law. And it tends to be wedged right in the middle of one of the least appreciated books of the Torah, and that's Vayikra, Leviticus. This is known as a priestly book. It has all the blood and gore and the sacrifices. And probably 6-7 years into our ministry within our group, I decided I was going to really study these sacrifices and stuff out. And I got into some pretty heavy reading of some of the different rabbis and the spiritual implications and of each of the sacrifices, you know, why the doves here and why the grain here and why for certain transgressions. And there's some really interesting stuff out there, and it kind of widens your understanding of sacrifice and korbanot and offering and those things. There's a physical connection usually between the type of offering and the transgression that's committed. They're just not happenstance. It's not just a fine or a penalty. You know, it's not just, oh, you're in trouble now, bring me your best of your herd because you've been a bad boy. It doesn't always work quite that way. Although there is, you're supposed to suffer a degree of loss when you transgress the laws of God. And when you're restored, you have to understand that there's a cost. And so that's a process of learning. And when you get into 613, they're divided up. They're not all commandments from that Greco-Roman mindset. Many of these, we loosely translate commandments as mitzvot in a general term, you know, which mitzvah is your deeds. But there are other Hebrew words for commandments that are translated. There are toldots. These are certain types of commandments that have to do with observances of festivals and stuff. And these are things that God doesn't give us a big gray area on how to do them. He says you're to do these things at certain times. There's hukim, you know. And so there's different definitions of commandments. It's important that you study that out. It's just kind of like the Hebrew concept of love cannot be encapsulated into our one English word love. You know, there's 5, 6, 7 different levels of understanding, different words used in different purposes. But in that, you have laws that, 365 no laws. Don't do this, don't do that. You've got another 200 and some. I don't have my little list. I'm sorry. I was thinking, I looked at this paper and thought, okay, I speak at 2:00. And so I know a lot of this stuff from the past. And so I was just going to write down my little outline. And at 10:30, I had this little thing in my spirit go, you know, I need to look at the book and just kind of look at the schedule and make sure that we don't mess anything up today. And then I go, oh, 15 minutes, I'm supposed to be speaking. So I jump in the truck. And see, I'm a big picture guy, which means I look at the big picture. I don't get focused too much on the details off the bat. And so I ran right over to that one. And then they say, oh, you're in the wrong building. Oh, well, I'll get back in the truck and get back over here. So that's what I did. So therefore, I walked in 2 minutes before we were supposed to start. So I don't have the full breakdown. But I have literally been working off and on for, I would say, 4 or 5 years. I have personal areas of study that I get fascinated with something and I start developing it out. And back in our congregation back in Kansas when I had it, we would always have new people coming in and new people coming out. And I developed quite a rack of tract literature. And I would always do some commentary at the beginning, focusing on what I feel the heart issue of these commandments. Like I have one on the Sabbath, and I had one on the names of God in Hebrew, the ones that started with the Aleph, and then I had a different one on the names that started with the Yud, and then I had one for Hanukkah, and so I developed probably, I don't know, I got 20 or 30 little tracts that sometime I need to dust them off, clean them up, and maybe just make them available. That's usually what I did. I just had them out and you just took them and that was cool. And if somebody asked me a question and I didn't have time to go into the full explanation, I could just grab this. Say, here, take this home and read it. It was 3 or 4 pages and it, you know, if they were really interested, anybody read 3 or 4 pages, you know. And I would put it pretty much in common speech in terms. But I've been working on a list of the 613 for probably 5-6 years, and I've looked at the various rabbi listings and stuff, and then I felt it was important to put them under topical headings, you know, the ones that pertain to the priests, the one that pertains to women, the ones that pertain to landowners, and the ones that are talking about how you treat your slaves. So I did all that, and Maimonides and many of the rabbis have different things, and then I decided I needed commentary to explain why I had it this way. So the 64 pages that it takes just to print the list has expanded into a small book of probably 200 pages at this point. And someday when I get the opportunity to complete it, I'll make it available. But so when you're studying this, God, right in the middle of the book of Vayikra, gives us a Torah portion, and that Torah portion is called Kodeshim, and it means a holy people. And in the middle of this, it means a holy people. Yeah, it's the holy ones. It's pluralized. You know, you have the im on the end of it. And so, if we will take this portion that God has right in the middle of all the sacrifices and the instructions for the Levites, it's kind of interesting because it is almost right in the middle of the book. And he gets specific, and he tells the people of Israel, remember he says, you know, you're to be holy because I'm a holy God. Well, he gets specific, and he defines what I believe are the weightier things of the law, the things that we need to pay extra care to. Because Vayikra, its name in Hebrew, means to call up. He's calling us up to a higher level of spirituality through this book. And he's doing so lovingly. And with his spirit. You've got that vav at the beginning, you know, he's calling you up. And so, when we would do the Torah portion, and even, I think even the rabbis, you know, on the normal cycle, you have to read two portions every Sabbath to stay on the Torah portion cycle for Vayikra. It's like, let's get through this one as fast as we can so we can get back to the history and the other parts. And I feel that it's probably the one that we need to spend more time on instead of less. So it's always good when you have a leap year and they split those portions out and you can develop them a little longer. And of course, back in the day, we used to start our congregation in the middle of the afternoon, and people would bring stuff for an oat egg. So, you know, we'd plug in the chili pot and soups and all that good stuff at the back of the thing. And there were many times it was midnight before anybody walked out that door, and we started at noon, so, you know. And they could come and go as they needed. But it says right off here in chapter 19 in Leviticus, it says, Adonai said to Moshe, speak to the entire community of Israel and tell them, your people are to be holy because I, Adonai, your God, am holy. Okay. Then he goes and he starts defining what he feels are the weightier things to being a holy people. Because God doesn't just tell you to do something without explaining how he wants it done, right? I mean, this is a book of instructions, after all. Right off the bat, he comes in and he says, every one of you is to revere your father and your mother. And you are to keep my Sabbaths. I am Adonai, your God. Well, in our culture, in our society, that's not always an easy task. Because not all of us have had fathers and mothers that have been nurturing and have raised us up with Scripture and a love for God or a love for anything. Some of us have had parents that have been quite abusive. I don't speak from being an abusive situation myself. I was never really abused as a child, although I was ignored, you know. I had my first conversation with my biological father when I was 27, and I had three children of my own. Walked into a Hardee's, of all things, and I looked over, and I just had this odd look on my face. My wife goes, what's wrong? I go, no, nothing. She goes, well, what's the deal? Why is that guy staring at you? I go, oh, that's because that's my dad, my real dad. She goes, oh, you ought to go over and say something. I said, oh, no, I haven't seen him since I was three. You know? We had a conversation. You know, he had changed his life around. You know, he was no longer drinking. My real dad, to his credit, we're great friends now. We have a wonderful relationship. I let him be a grandfather to my children. So he did get to enjoy that. My girls were probably 7, 5, and 3 at the time. So he got to see these girls grow up. And he only had 2 natural children, me and my little sister. But he comes from a poor background. His dad was not there, and he ran around with an ornery bunch of kids in a really poor rural town and got in a lot of trouble as a young man. Met my mother, and they got in a lot of trouble together. You know, they weren't living that much of a godly lifestyle. My mom and her twin brother used to sing country music in bars. They were musicians and talented along that way, but my uncle was in the service, and Darlene and David, they're twins, and they would just, you know, go wherever they could play. But when my mom got us, and they got married for all the right, I mean, they loved each other, they got married, and then 2 years later they had kids. But when my mom had kids, she stopped going to the bars and stopped doing that thing, and he didn't want to do that, you know? Because that meant he had to actually show up to work so he could pay the rent and all those other things. And so he just disappeared. You know, it was a simple thing. But later on in life, he ran into a situation where the doctors told him, you know, hey, if you don't stop this lifestyle, you're not going to be 55. You know, you got to stop. So he did. And then, wow, it's an amazing thing when a guy gets sober, you know, they start looking at all their mistakes and all that other stuff. So it was a God thing. It was a good timing. And actually, my wife goes, well, it's too bad you weren't raised around your real dad. I go, if you met the family? We went to a few class reunions. She goes, you know, it's probably a pretty good thing. You guys really didn't have a lot of contact till you were full grown. I said, yeah, it was. To give you an indication of this family, we're in Missouri. My family has a lot of history in Missouri on the biological side. Pretty Boy Floyd. Cantrell and his Raiders. And that's just on the Floyd side.
I got Jesse James.
Yeah, I got Jesse James in there too. His mother, however, my grandmother, sweet woman, she is a half Jewish and half Indian. Her father is a Cohen, Bill Cowan. He came over here, got kicked out of England for whatever reason. I got kicked out of Tennessee, got kicked out of Kentucky, landed in Kansas, married an Indian woman, and had kids. So she's half Delaware Indian and half Jewish with no observance or anything other than the fact that she knows she's Jewish. And that's my father's mother. A sweet lady, and we just lost her a couple years ago. And I had the privilege. And see, here's the beautiful thing about that. They had 6, 7 kids, you know. I've got a whole line of uncles and 2 aunts on that side, bunch of cousins. And all those families are just broken. There isn't a single healthy marriage family situation. Those cousins are, you know, this one's in jail this week and this one got, you know, busted for the meth lab or whatever. And it's just sad. But when my grandmother died, I got the phone call to do the funeral. You know, that was kind of neat. And so, you know, I did my dad's funeral when he passed, my adopted father's funeral when he passed away. That was the first funeral I ever did.
Was that difficult for you?
No, it actually was quite neat, because I had a lot of admiration and respect for my adopted father, even though on an emotional level we weren't very close.
What about the other funeral? Was that
part? He's still there.
The first funeral you did
with my adopted father?
Yeah,
no, it was good. It was really good. It was kind of a God thing all the way around. And, you know, I got my mom's family's the opposite. You know, they're good people. They're smart. They're all school teachers and musicians and artists. And, you know, they're a bunch of Swedish farmers, you know, and just big, loving people. And you don't go anywhere without getting fed 3 times. And so, yeah. And so... So it's kind of an interesting background. So in a way, if you want to take the ruling of the rabbis, you know, where if you got a Jewish mother, you're Jewish, so that would make my real dad Jewish, so that would make me kind of Jewish twice removed. So I'm a Cohen twice removed. So it wouldn't work for temple service, I can guarantee that. But if I filled out a form, I might be able to slip in on Aliyah someplace if I got the right rabbi to give me immigration papers. I've got a couple friends over in Israel that I've helped in one regard or another, and one of them is Avi ben Mordecai's brother Yuri, and he's in Jerusalem, and he's always, you know, I got him some speaking engagements and different things, and he's a character. I tell you, I've met some of the most unique individuals in this movement over the years, and I love every one of them. I really do. And he's always, you got to come over here and bring your daughters, because I have three sons. I got them all married off almost now. I've only got one that's not married. So it's like, okay. But I did tell him he better keep an extra bed ready, because when I'm coming, I expect a hospitality. So, you know, I'm storing up favors in the land. That's what I'm doing. I'm going to get back to the portion. So it's honor your father and mother. I had to come to a point where I honored my father and mother for their shortcomings and stuff in spite of that, you know? And that's okay. And I let go of any angst and resentment I had as a young man, and I grew up and I matured. And I have a great deal of respect for my parents, the things they've been through and the points they are in their life and the struggles that they go through. And we do. We get to that point where we, at one stage of our life, usually, where we become our parents' parent. Whether it's financially, in a healthcare issue, or whatever. And hopefully God has softened your heart to get you to that point. Then he says right after that, he says, do not turn to idols. Don't cast metal gods for yourselves, for I am Adonai your God. So just like honoring your father and mother, he wants you to honor your father in heaven. That's an important thing. And when you offer the sacrifices of peace offerings to Adonai, offer it in a way that will make you accepted. Okay, this isn't getting into the technical aspects necessarily. That's what the priests were to help you with anyways. But when you did it, it was about that heart issue again, okay? Don't go in there and go, well, dang it, I screwed up. I'll just, you know. Or go and screw up and think it's only going to cost me this. I've had a good year. I don't care. I can sin a little because I can pay for it. I think sometimes people think they can do that too, you know? They think they're given a... And then he says it is to be eaten the same day that you offer it following the day, but if any of it remains until the third day, it is to be burned up completely. And we get people going, well, why is he talking about consuming? Well, gosh, even though you're supposed to be doing something for him, he's concerned with your well-being. And we now know with modern science and refrigeration that, you know, you leave your chicken set out too long on the picnic table, you shouldn't be eating it, or you're going to not have a good day tomorrow. If any of it is eaten on the third day, it will become a disgusting thing and will not be accepted. Moreover, anyone who eats it and will bear the consequences of profaning something holy meant for Adonai, they're again set apart. That person will be cut off from his people. And that goes into that discussion we had this morning at the Deuteronomy reading. When you brought up the part in there, when they talked about that if an animal dies on its own volition, you can sell it to the foreigner or stranger if you want to, or give it to them, and they can consume it, but you don't eat it. Because when...
I think that was Deuteronomy 14. Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't have meat at every meal. They were not a steak and potato society. When you slew an animal, which many of them were, you know, shepherds and herders anyways, you know, you wouldn't eat your investment, you know. When people own a business, they don't go in and pilfer their own business for their own personal things. They go, no, that one I can get some money out of, you know. They protect this. This is their livelihood, their investment. So they didn't eat meat constantly. That's why when they had these festivals and stuff and they did the sacrifices, these things, it was a joyous time. The majority of the sacrifices in the temple, contrary to our former Christian mindset, was not, oh, I got to go to the temple because I messed up and I got to do the sin offering. Yeah, that was part of it. But there was a lot of times that was brought for rejoicing and as a thank you gift for God, because God did something great. And so you grabbed your people, your friends, you said, look, we're going to the house of the Lord. We're going to have a party. We're going to thank God for how He's blessed us in this situation, the circumstance. He brought back my kid from a long trip. We had a great year. You know, something great. And you thanked God for it. And you went to His house to enjoy it. Okay? And this was your app. Okay? When people, you know, they're so focused on blood constantly, they forget about the heart issue. Moreover, anyone that eats it after the third day will be profaning what is holy. That person will be cut off from his people. If you make light these things, there's a point where God says, look, you know better. And then he penalizes you. He doesn't have time to mess with somebody who knows better and should be doing the right thing and decides that they're just flat not going to do it. They're in rebellion. So he's not going to waste his time. He's got other things to do. So fine, go deal with your consequences. When you get your consequences and you're dealing with it, then we'll see if your teshuva, your repentance is real. And we'll deal with that then. So, you know, it's better to be that way. When you harvest the ripe crops produced in your land, don't harvest all the way to the corners of the field. Don't gather up the ears of the grain left to the harvesters. Likewise, don't gather the grapes left on the vine or fallen onto the ground after the harvest. Leave them for the poor, the foreigner, for I am Adonai your God. The next thing he gets into is what? Love your neighbor as yourself. Just like Yeshua said, these are the two most important commands. He talks about your father and your mother. He talks about his relationship with him. And then he moves right on to your relationship with your neighbors. And not just your neighbors, but those who are less fortunate. As a community, we should not need the governmental welfare system. Our towns and stuff should be able to take care of their own. If people who had would share with those who have not. And here, these people who were harvesting, they were landowners. They were the wealthy guys. You know? They weren't to harvest to the corner. You know, the rabbis say they'd go and they'd stick a stick in the center of the field with a string and make a circle, and then they would just harvest within that circle and they'd leave those corners there for everybody else. You know, there's also a commandment on every third year to take that extra tithe, not the tithe, that you set aside to go to Sukkot and to celebrate, to the poor and the Levites so that they could join in the festival, because he understands that there's always going to be people who don't have enough. And I tell you, it's no fun when you're down there. There's been a few Sukkots in our past because we were a young couple with young kids and you're struggling. You know, and I've had good years as a business owner and bad years. And there's times we came to Sukkot and we had just enough money to get home at the end of it, you know. And we were eating, you know, our little kosher hot dogs and our beanies and weenies, you know, through the whole festival because we weren't spending the money. But, and then there's been years where I had a lot of money. There's been times where we spent a lot in the resource room buying stuff. There's been times where I've given money to get people here, put them in my car, you know, drug them. We used to go back to Kansas all the time. And there was longest time we were the only ones from our congregation coming. We used to tell them, you guys need to get ready. You need to prepare. You should really do this. You should do this. And so many of them would say, yeah, I'm going to do it. And then right up to the last minute, the preparations didn't happen. Then there were a few ladies that really needed to be here from a heart issue. I'm still waiting for Brenda to get to one of these things because she's never been to a festival. Brenda Kreitz. And she's always struggling. And Brenda is one of the smartest ladies in the movement that I've met. I have a great respect with Brenda. Before I met Brenda, she studied with a man who worked with Joab, Steve Salters. He spent some time in Bartlesville, and Brenda lived in Coffeyville about 30 miles away. And she went back and forth for a period of time and really learned a lot from Steve. I've never met Steve, but I heard a lot about him from the people that he touched at his time, and he was in Oklahoma. And I knew that he ended up going down and working with Joe for a few years. So it's kind of interesting how that works. But Brenda's just really smart, intellectual person. But a few of the ladies, and it was like right after we left, there was one year that a bunch of the ladies finally got together and they came here. So we had a nice little reunion. We had more people here from our congregation sometimes than we'd have show up at the Sabbath. It's almost cute. It was great. And it was joy. And then we had another lady who was a very dear friend of mine that she came that year. And it just, you know, it. She said, "Oh, Darren, you're so right," and she said, "Oh, you know, it just meant the world to her." We would have conversations on the phone occasionally, and I think 6 months after that, she died very unexpectedly. And I was very thankful that she got to experience these things. Yeah, it wasn't. It was that she, and it was a fluke. You know, I got a phone call. We were in Oklahoma, and at that time we had moved. We were close to Joplin, and I got a phone call, and they said that she had died. And I'm like, what? I didn't even know she was sick. Oh, well, we thought she just had the flu. We checked her into the hospital, and Mary, one of the ladies, had gone up and spent some time with her that evening. She was looking better. Came back the next day, and they told her she died in the middle of the night. You know? And so it was a sad thing. It was a sad thing for a lot of us, you know. I was gifted when I went in, and our congregation really started growing. My congregation was full of school teachers and pastors. Wasn't that neat? We'd meet on the Sabbath. I had two or three Sunday pastors come into our Sabbath meetings to study Torah with us. And a whole slew of school teacher ladies, you know, a counselor from Neodoshe Sandy and Rachel and Esther and a whole slew of them. It was quite a group, and we had some phenomenal discussions. It was really good. And Carol was a school teacher for years. Lois.
So are they still Sunday pastors?
Some of them are, yeah. One gentleman used to be a pastor in a holiness church. And then he spent a period of time not pastoring. His wife has a huge heart for Hebraic Roots Movement. And when he got the opportunity to go pastor at the Church of the Brethren, he went and did that. And he stopped coming when he started getting grief about somebody saying, oh, you've been to that Jewish thing on Saturday, haven't you? And so... But Phil's still a very dear friend, and we would, you know, when he would be studying some of the scripture and he'd have a question, we had a great discussion on sacrifice one evening. I had 3 or 4 hours on the phone. We really went into pretty depth, and he's a great man. He's got a great heart. I believe we need people to be those gateways to really get people interested in the Lord. My father-in-law comes from an Assembly of God background, and he. You know, he grew up when he hit 53, and he used to be a school teacher. He used to teach English and drama and all that stuff in high school, but he's now a Methodist minister. And of course, he's not a Methodist. He used to go around, he's an ex-hippie, he used to go around and play his guitar and sing old Keith Green songs and stuff like that in churches, and he would basically go anywhere that would allow him to sing, you know, that was his thing. And he does have a big heart for God, I got to give him that. When he was a young man, he even started a seminary at a Lutheran seminary, but when he got there and realized half of his teachers didn't even believe in God, he kind of left that behind and decided he was just going to teach high school, so... and left the seminary. But he later on in life, he did that, and then God had to humble him, because what happened is, back there in Kansas, you have all these little country churches, and they're Methodist churches. And at the time, the Methodists came through and put a church everywhere there was a post office. And so the Methodist diocese have maintained many of these churches, and they're very small congregations. They'd be maybe the size of what we have in this room right now. And... they would have 3 to 5 churches in a parish. And so the pastor will do 2 to 3 sermons every Sunday, basically hour-long sermons. He start one at 9 and go to the other one and do it at 11 and then the other one. This, well, in this particular parish over there in that part of Kansas, there's 5. And they would have an official minister, and then he had a minister's helper who basically got minimum wage to kind of switched back and forth with this guy. So my father-in-law was teaching high school in Longton, Kansas, a very small, dinky butt town. And he started being the help. He got asked by this pastor of the Methodist church to be his helper. So he would do a couple of churches one Sunday when the pastor was doing the 3, and then they'd switch. And that was good for him, because it helped him grow and grow up. And then later on, he went ahead and had the opportunity to become a full-time minister. He doesn't do Torah either. We have some pretty lively discussions. But his heart's in the right place. And it was cute, because he had moved to up by Fort Scott, Kansas, pretty larger town. He had been given a larger parish, and he had two churches in that. One of them was about 150 people. And he was leaving for vacation, and he could not find anybody to fill in. So I get this phone call. And he goes, look, I don't have anybody to fill in for me when I leave for vacation. Would you come and speak at my churches? But I got to warn you, first off, you've got to stick to the official thing that his diocese would put out. This is what you teach on this Sunday. So you got to teach on that. I said, okay, Dale, I'll just come and I'll keep it all biblical. I won't go into any denominational theological discussion. We'll just talk Bible. Just give me the scriptures and we'll just talk Bible. I came here and taught it like a Torah portion. Studied out the scriptures. And I had people, there was a little old lady, 80, 90 years old in that church her entire life. It lit up like the 4th of July. You know? And he gets back and he goes, I don't know what you did to my people when I got back, but they just wouldn't shut up. And so the next thing you know, I got invited. And for 3 months, I did every Methodist church up and down that corridor of Kansas on Sundays. From Pittsburgh to Kansas City and back. Yeah. And I used to tell my wife, I said, you know, I'll walk in any church. I don't care what the name on it, as long as I'm able to talk about the Bible and I don't have to get into any denominational debates. And just share God. That's all you got to do. Yeah, they were. But it was interesting. And I've been in Holy Roller Pentecostal, and I've been, you know, and some of these Methodist churches are almost Catholic. You know, they still do the Apostles' Creed and the whole thing, and it was quite interesting. So it didn't bother me. It's a great opportunity. And I've met God. God has jewels everywhere. You know, He's got some of the neatest people in these congregations and these communities, and I've met some wonderful people. Now I'm off on that bunny trail. I gotta get back here. So here he's talking about the poor. He's talking about your community. Okay, in the Hebraic Roots movement, we get into this all the time because God says you're a holy people, and come out of her, my people, and be separate, and be peculiar, and be unique. So then we have a tendency to get off and get in our own little group and think, well, you know, well, we're fine off over here. And we're just going to be separate. And we're just in the poor world. And it's all sick and gross and icky. And we'll just let them be. I mean, we're just going to stay here. That's not what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be getting out there in our communities. We're supposed to be making change. I talked about tikkun a little bit when I was speaking about fathers. That our life should be an outflowing. And you can't flow unless you have something to give. So the first thing you got to do is work on yourself. And when you get that halfway to a stable point where you're starting to bear fruit on this tree, then you got to work on your family, you know. And then once your family, then boom, you reach out to the community. One of the things that I have three daughters, beautiful daughters. I get to say that proudly as a father. They're beautiful inside and out. And our girls, when they got to be young, almost teenagers, would have a Hanukkah party. And it was interesting that they had this huge group of friends, many of them not in any kind of church, but they wanted to come to the Brady girls' Hanukkah party, and our house would have 50 to 60 teenagers in it for a Hanukkah party that my girls were throwing, and they were all kids. That was pretty cool. And then, you know, our girls did Hebraic dance and they were good at it. And my oldest really got to where she could teach and all that stuff. And we had friends she went with a friend to a Sunday school class one time. And the guy comes walking up to me and he goes, you know, your daughter knows more of the Bible than I do. I go, well, you know, she studies. She's a good kid. And he goes, well, and they did this Hebrew dance thing, and it was just awesome. And could they come to our youth group and teach the kids the dance? They came to that youth group. They didn't just teach the kids the dance. They taught those kids Torah. I get Facebook requests from those kids that my kids talk to all the time. I have four or five of those young men, you know, that have scattered to the wind, that call me occasionally, send me an email, ask me a question, you know. That's awesome. That's touching your community. I didn't go after these kids. You gotta know Yahweh. You know. They saw something and they had to be around it. That's pretty cool. That's what I'm talking about. Just be who God has called you to be, and don't be afraid. Just live it out. Walk it out. You know, I tell people that, you know, I'll invite them over to dinner, and they go, where's your house at? And I explain to them, they go, oh, you're the one that has the Israeli flag in the front yard. Well, yeah, we did at the time. That was one of the things we did for a long time, was we flew flags. And I got an interesting visit on 9/11 from the police.
Really?
Yeah, we got a knock at the door, and they asked us if we would remove our flag. And I go, why? And they go, well, I don't know if you know what's happened today or not. I go, oh, yeah, but that's the other guys. You know, that's just what I said. He goes, well, some of these rednecks don't know the difference. I go, well, okay. I mean, for consideration from that standpoint, I thought, okay, no big deal. So I did bring the flag in for a day or so, but you know, it was never an issue. You know, I was a business owner in that town. Everybody knew me, and you know, they either liked me or didn't. I wasn't running for office, so I didn't care too much about that. I just who I am. But it was odd. It's just one of those things that it just comes out of left field. You don't think, and I'm overly optimistic. I never, you know. I had a friend when we first moved there. He goes, "Man, you need to be a cop. You'd make a great cop." I go, "What makes you think I'd make a great cop?" He goes, well, you know, you're big and you walk in the room and blah, blah, blah. And I go, and I'm stupid. He goes, you're stupid. I said, first of all, I've never owned a gun. My dad didn't have any. And I said, I'd have to learn all that. And I don't have any fear because as a kid, I was always racing cars and motorcycles and doing stupid stuff. So I would walk into a situation, not have enough brains to have a gun pulled or whatever, and somebody just shoot me. And so it would be really stupid. And I said, then, I don't like politics. So if something came along that I had to do that I felt morally was against my morals, I would have a conflict right there. And I wouldn't do it. So then, if the department was corrupt or whatever, they would have to get rid of me. So one way or the other. So it just would be bad. Because I've always been something of a crusader. Yeah, yeah. So no, I've always found it's better off. I always said I'd make a great king and a terrible president, you know. let's see. Where was I? Okay, so we're talking about the poor and taking care of people and feeding people. You know, the earliest part of our ministry, when Wendy and I did our ministry for a change, because the early, 7 years of ministry that we did was always somebody else's congregation that we had to shoulder the responsibilities for. You know, somebody else started, and then you be the Torah teacher. And then pretty soon, and you pay the bills, and then you do this, and you find us a meeting hall, and you do this. And I was just like, okay. Because I'm an easygoing guy. And it took them 3 months, and they couldn't find a building. And then they called me and said, you got to find us a meeting place. And I made 2 phone calls, and we had a building that afternoon. Like, you know, some people make the smallest things difficult. You know, you're like, So anyways, but that part of our ministry, when Wendy and I decided, okay, we're gonna do it the way we feel God wants us to do it, what we did was a once a month Sabbath meal. And we fed people. And we went and we had a place that didn't cost us a penny to have, a big dining hall, an assisted living home. It had been remodeled. It was pretty. And I would spend about $200 on food and groceries for that one meal. I made sure, and it was a potluck. People could bring stuff, but I made sure that if nobody brought anything or everybody brought cookies, that there was enough to be a meal each time. And we always had a meal, and it was great. And it kind of that last incarnation grew out of just our giving out, you know. And I didn't have a box out. I didn't have anything out. Nobody gave any money. I refused it for 2.5 years. Didn't want it because I didn't want anybody to say something negative about it, because I'd seen that happen over and over and over and over and over. When the congregations got to a certain size, it was always an argument based on money or hierarchy or eldership or deacons and all that baloney business, and they just, you know, complicated everything. I wasn't going there. So anyways, let's go back, and it says, and this is important. I think this is great. So right after he talks about feeding people and taking care of that, he comes back and he says, do not steal from, defraud, or lie to each other. Don't swear by my name falsely, which would be profaning the name of God, for I am Adonai. Do not oppress or rob your neighbor. Specifically, you are not to keep back the wages of a hired worker all night until morning. These are just basically respecting people in your daily dealings. Don't speak a curse against a deaf person or place an obstacle in the path of a blind person. Rather, fear your God, for I am Adonai. And that's compassion. You know, when kids are young, they don't know any different. And you got, you know, children who are handicapped mentally or this and that. And they make fun of them because they don't know no better. But God instructs us to be compassionate to people at whatever level they are. Okay? And then he comes in right after that. And all this is about just normal community stuff. This isn't congregational stuff. This is just people. This is how you should be as a person. He comes in and he says, don't be unjust or judging. Show neither partiality to the poor nor defense to the mighty, but with justice judge your neighbor. We're not supposed to be sitting here telling everybody what we think they should or shouldn't be doing, and you know, and all that baloney business. I let God be the judge. It's kind of his forte anyways, and stuff. Do not go around speaking slander among your people, but also don't stand idly by when your neighbor's life is at stake. I am Adonai. Okay, this is an important thing here. Because when I talk about slander, slander is Lashon Hara in Hebrew. It's evil speech. And they say Lashon Hara is one of the greatest transgressions. It was one of the few things in the Torah that you could get kicked out of the congregation or the camp for. When Miriam was complaining about Moses to Aaron and all that stuff, she got kicked out of the camp for a couple weeks, right? Got struck with leprosy. Character assassination can ruin people's lives. In this town years ago that we lived in for 20 years, there was a family, and the gentleman had been a school teacher. And a group of young girl students got together, and they didn't like this guy. And they cooked up a little plot to get rid of this dude. And they falsely accused him of, you know, inappropriate touching and this kind of stuff with girls. The guy was innocent. Even when he was proven innocent, it didn't matter, because there was enough suspicion around that town from that moment on that their life there was ruined. There was no way of really restoring that. Especially when you get into the small town, you got the small town politics that comes with that. So there they are, you know, 20 some years in that town, in their home and all that stuff, and they got to leave and start all over. The false accusations of somebody else. The rabbis call Lashon Hara, they say it's equal to murder. Because in a way, that's what you're doing. You're destroying a person's life. You may not be destroying their breath, but you're wrecking the rest of it and making their life miserable. So it's very important that we guard our tongue. So when people come up to you in this movement, because we have beautiful people in the Hebraic Roots movement, unique, one-of-a-kind individuals in every stage, whether they're leaders and teachers, and they're unique, love them. And if somebody comes up and goes, well, I don't like this guy, I think he's a nut, and I think he's going to go, eh. I used to just focus on their good stuff. I go, well, you know, that guy's got a really great teaching on tithing, though. Or that guy's really smart in this area. That's just not my area. I'm letting him develop it. I think he's funny, or I think he's, you know, interesting character. And sometimes they're in the process, you know. If God will take care of it if it's a bad thing. I don't feel the obligation to have to go on a crusade against my fellow guy. You know, you gotta respect their uniqueness. I don't think I got it all figured out. I don't necessarily think they all do either. So let's be graceful and give people their space and room to grow. And then it says, don't hate your brother in your heart, but rebuke your neighbor frankly, so you won't carry sin because of him. Don't take vengeance or bear a grudge against any of your people. Rather, love your neighbor as yourself, for I am Adonai. You know, people are going to make mistakes. Sometimes things people are going to say are going to hurt feelings and step on toes. But, you know, be a big enough person to let it roll. Be a big enough person to forgive. Sometimes they'll ask for forgiveness and sometimes they don't. Forgive them anyways. You know? Observe, and then he comes in and he says, okay, he deals with all this relationship stuff, community stuff, and God and family stuff, and then he says, observe my regulations. Okay, now let's talk about the other stuff. You know? Let's talk about Torah and the Sabbath and all these things now. Because I want you to be a good person so that when you do these other things, people will pay attention. Because if you go around and you say, you got to do this, and you're just a crab, it's, well, what's Paul come in there? I may do all these things, I might be a martyr, but if I don't have love, it's nothing. And, you know, that hellfire, damnation, brimstone message, you know, it, you don't catch a lot of bees with vinegar. So, okay, let's see. Observe my regulations. Don't let your livestock... And then he gets into some of those things. Don't let your livestock mate with another kind. Don't sow your field with two different kinds of grain. Don't wear a garment of cloth made with two different kinds of thread. If a man has relations with a woman who is a slave intended for another man, she has neither been redeemed nor given her freedom. There will be an investigation. They are not to be put to death because she was not free. The interesting thing is we have this concept of what marriage is in our culture. And then God has a concept of what marriage is. A man has relations with a woman and she's unmarried. Guess who's responsible for that woman now for the rest of their life? That man. That's why Jacob had four wives. You know. Now, I will come back and say, I don't advocate polygamy because I can't show you one instance in Scripture where a man with more than one wife is happy. Okay? So I would counsel anybody who is thinking of having more than one wife or trying to find some way to justify it. I wouldn't go down that road. That's no fun. You know, you don't know what you're getting yourself into there, buddy. It's usually quite a period of grief. It's interesting. I wonder what Jacob's life would have been like if it just would have been him and Rachel. You know? I mean, he truly loved Rachel. But when you look at his life and all the troubles he went through, few of them were as a result of her relationship, his relationship with her. They're usually a result of everything else. You know? So, there you go. Then we have she was not free. The Kohen will make an atonement for him. There again you come back to the Kohen. The Kohen in Israel did not just serve as the office of the priest. We understand that, don't we? In each community there were Kohens. In each little town they were scattered in Israel. They only went and served in the temple like 2 weeks every so often, you know, in divisions. Their division would be called up, they would go, they would do their service in the temple, and then they would have to go back to the communities in which they were planted in. There they ran the schools, the yeshivas, they taught the children. They had Kohens that were the officials, you know, they guarded the gates, they did the rulings. They, when this neighbor argued with this neighbor, they were the judges. You know, they were the police, they were the, you know, they had the task of making sure everybody was taken care of and things were done fairly, okay? And so that's an important thing for us to realize. They were also the physicians. You know, they had to inspect people when they with illnesses to make sure that everybody else in the community didn't get sick. When you enter into the land and plant various kinds of fruit trees, you are to regard its fruit as forbidden. For 3 years it will be forbidden to you and not eaten. In the fourth year its fruit will be holy for praising Adonai, and in the fifth year you may eat its fruit, so that it will produce even more for you. I am Adonai your God. Well, now, you know, horticulturalists and people who are into agriculture understand that you have to let a tree go through a cycle of nurturing its own roots before it becomes really fruitful and multiply. You can't just run out there and grab the apples the first time they start appearing and expect that tree to really come into its full maturity. Just like in our movement, when a person starts coming into this, you can't just go out there and throw them into a situation and say, oh, you've been here 3 months. You start teaching, you start talking to people, and you start sharing. There's a time of maturing, and before everybody starts telling everybody how to tie zeets in the right amount of knots and how to wrap the blue cord certain amount of times, let them grow in their observance and understanding these things, and don't beat. Let people beat people over the head with these things.